Today is Wednesday, August 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. First Lady Melania Trump headlined the second day of the Republican National Convention.
Donald will not rest until he has done all he can.
As violence erupted in Wisconsin. Resulting in at least two deaths. Plus, why Hong Kong artists fear their work may be targeted by the security law. We'll have these stories and more next. On the second night of the four-day Republican National Convention, First Lady Melania Trump offered her case for a second term for U.S. President Donald Trump, joining others, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, who broke with tradition and delivered his speech from Jerusalem. White House correspondent Patsy Wittikuswara starts us off.
From the White House Rose Garden, First Lady Melania Trump sought to convince Americans that her husband deserves a second term, addressing a key concern among voters.
Donald will not rest until he has done all he can to take care of everyone impacted by this terrible pandemic.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo delivered remarks from Jerusalem, breaking protocol of State Department employees avoiding openly partisan activities while abroad.
The president, too, moved the U.S. Embassy to this very city of God, Jerusalem, the rightful capital of the Jewish homeland.
Pompeo highlighted Trump's recent announcement of the normalization of relations between the United Arab Emirates and Israel, a deal rejected by Palestinians. He also reminded voters of Trump's America First doctrine.
So I think you will continue to see gestures to what the Trump presidency thinks are its whims. And I think Pompeo's appearance in Jerusalem is probably the chief among those gestures and also meant to mobilize voters who really care about Israel.
Following Donald Trump Jr.'s speech on Monday, siblings Eric and Tiffany also touted their father's achievements.
On Tuesday, Trump again made appearances from the White House, breaking tradition from presidential nominees who usually stay out of the limelight until the last night of the convention.
Despite his hardline immigration policies, Trump witnessed the naturalization ceremony of five new Americans, another first in convention history.
You've earned the most prized, treasured, cherished, and priceless possession anywhere in the world. It's called American citizenship.
While former Presidents Barack Obama, Bill Clinton, and Jimmy Carter spoke at last week's Democratic National Convention, former Republican President George W. Bush is not featured this week. He and his late father, former President George H.W. Bush, also sat out the RNC 2016 convention.
I think what this speaks to is the revolution in the party that Donald Trump has effected over 4 years. He has changed the Republican Party more than any man since Ronald Reagan.
Vice President Mike Pence will formally accept his nomination in a speech scheduled for Wednesday. Patsy Wittikuswara, VOA News at the White House.
The world is approaching 24 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, as the University of Cambridge says it hopes to begin trials of a novel vaccine designed to protect against COVID-19 and other related coronaviruses later this year. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma has that story.
Researchers at DioSinvax, a company spun off by Cambridge in 2017, have developed the vaccine using three-dimensional computer modeling of all known coronaviruses to create synthetic genes that train the immune system to target the disease. The vaccine can be freeze-dried and stored as a powder, making transport and storage easier because it doesn't need to be refrigerated. Jonathan Heaney, who leads in viral zoonotics, says we're looking for chinks in its armour, crucial pieces of the virus that we can use to construct a vaccine to create the immune response in the right direction. Charles de Ledesma, London.
Many dental practices chose to restrict themselves to emergency cases only and to put off routine procedures such as teeth cleaning and filling cavities during the pandemic. But now, many dentists in the United States are reopening their doors for non-emergency treatment with enhanced safety measures designed to protect both patients and the staff from infection. To find out more about how dentists have been preparing, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Dr. Ramesh Nalia, the Associate Dean of Patient Services at the University of Michigan School of Dentistry in Ann Arbor. He says that dentistry has always been driven by preventative care and patient safety, but much of that has changed.
But what we have to do to accomplish those goals has changed a lot. We are having to control aerosols as much as possible.
What is aerosol, actually?
Aerosol is the spray that's developed from the dental drill, the handpieces. There's different levels of spray. There's large droplets, small droplets, and it is not well understood what risk each poses in terms of transmission of COVID, but dentistry and healthcare in general is just taking the most cautious approach that everything is high risk. And so our work is aggressively to limit aerosols. We are also having to space out our patients in waiting rooms and in treatment areas. We, of course, have higher costs associated with patient protective equipment. And for a variety of reasons, we're having to reduce the volume of patients that we can see each day.
Isn't reopening a bit scary for you and your staff during COVID?
At the start of the pandemic, it was a little scary because not much was known. But now several months have passed, and to my knowledge, there's not one case of dental office transmission. And the new measures that we're taking, which is high-grade masks, higher-grade gowns, face shields, with those, I feel quite safe. And for our patients, we've done a lot of things in terms of distancing them in time and space from other patients, so they are well protected as well.
Speaking to the dentists of the world, what do you think are the basics they should have in place to open up safely?
That's actually a tough question because dental offices are so variable across the country. For us, because we're so large and we have clinical spaces that are so large, it's very important to learn and understand airflow in our building to make sure that we know where aerosols are generated and how they're flowing and how they're being filtered, and also the filtration of our air units, which no one worried about before, but these have all become a key part of delivering safe dental care. But in smaller offices, it's possible, I think, to provide treatment and close that room for a period of time.
A couple of weeks ago, the World Health Organization said that non-essential dental care should be postponed while the pandemic is still going on. What's your take?
Unfortunately, I strongly disagree with that statement for three reasons. First, as I said, as far as I'm aware, there's not even one recorded case that is direct spread in a dental office. When members of a dental office have tested positive, it has been attributed to community spread. Second thing is, neglected dental care has consequences. The simplicity of dentistry is that almost everything we treat is completely preventable. But if we're not preventing it, it will come back to bite us, and it'll be more severe than if it was identified and treated earlier. The third thing is, there is a connection between oral health and overall health. I have studied oral systemic health for more than a decade, and when you neglect oral health, it affects your whole body. There are associations between oral health and diabetes, pregnancy outcomes, cardiovascular health, and there are more and more connections being discovered every year. So I think asking people to delay dental care is actually very dangerous, and I'm worried that the WHO statements may actually cause more harm than good.
Do you think the fact that so many people have put off their regular treatment for so long that will overwhelm the small dental practices that are opening up now?
You know, I think that is actually a very thoughtful question. I totally agree with the need to lock down elective procedures when so little was known about the virus. So when patients could not access us for several months, there is a build-up of need. But added to that, our capacity has reduced a little bit because of the social distancing and because we're spacing out treatment and the number of people that we're able to see in a day is less. So it is definitely an access to care pressure point. But I would certainly urge a continuance of that caution until perhaps more and more is known about the characteristics of the virus that enable us to release some of the restrictions that we have.
Dr. Ramesh Nalia is the Associate Dean of Patient Services at the University of Michigan School of Dentistry. He was speaking to VOA's Adam Phillips. And coming up later,
the Hong Kong artist who goes under the pen name Arto has a history of tackling sensitive subjects. His drawings have explored topics censored across the border in mainland China, including the 1989 crackdown on protesters in Tiananmen Square.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
The Earth's magnetic field protects us from the continuous onslaught of dangerous and highly charged space particles and radiation. There is an unusually weak spot in the magnetic field called the South Atlantic Anomaly, located above South America, approximately 200 to 300 kilometers off the coast of Brazil. This dip in the magnetic field can allow some space particles to reach closer to Earth's surface than normal. Scientists say that while the anomaly doesn't really affect our daily lives, it could interfere with and damage satellites traveling through it. Scientists at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center say recent observations show that the anomaly is expanding to the west, and the magnetic field intensity there is getting weaker and is slowly splitting into two lobes, which could mean additional problems for satellite missions. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A third night of street protests over the police shooting of a black man erupted into gun violence late Tuesday and early Wednesday in Kenosha, Wisconsin, killing two people and wounding one. Kenosha has been rocked by protests since Sunday when police shot Jacob Blake in the back at close range. After struggling with police, Blake broke free and walked away from them, around his car to the driver's side, where he was shot after opening the door, according to a bystander video that went viral. Three of his young children were in the car, according to witnesses. One of Blake's lawyers said it would take a miracle for him to walk again, and another family attorney said that they would be filing a civil lawsuit against the police department over the shooting. Police have said little about what happened other than they were responding to a domestic dispute, and the Wisconsin Department of Justice is investigating the incident. The situation in Wisconsin, the outrage over the killing of George Floyd, and incidents like those have shown a spotlight on the controversial U.S. legal doctrine called qualified immunity, which is given to law enforcement officers. A Reuters investigation has found that U.S. courts vary widely in how they grant police immunity, as Jonah Green explains.
Shots fired.
Don't nobody deserve what I'm going through. Don't nobody deserve that, man.
David Colley was gunned down by police in Fort Worth, Texas in July of 2016. He was approached by two officers who had been searching the area for two suspects, wanted for stealing a pair of tennis shoes.
Got a black male with no shirt and basketball shorts.
Colley pulled his hand out of his pocket, and one of the officers fired.
Robber 4156 had one black male hit to the back. Shots fired.
5 seconds elapsed from the cops first appearing to the shooting.
Just trying not to move, right?
A bullet severed Collie's spine.
Open your legs for me.
Leaving him paralyzed from the waist down. Since then, he's lived in nursing homes, unable to work, with bed sores and bouts of depression.
Wrapped up, caught up in a nightmare, man. Caught up in a nightmare. That's how I really feel like, truly.
To many Americans, the outlines of Collie's story have become terribly familiar, all the more since the death of George Floyd.
Put your hand up there!
But the fate of Collie's attempt at seeking justice has become familiar, too. He had committed no crime, but he didn't receive any compensation or his day in court because of something called qualified immunity.
They covered up for you in the courtroom. They snuck in a qualified immunity, still covering for you. And then at the same time, we're going to give you a promotion.
So it's a legal term. And for years, the words qualified immunity were rarely heard outside of legal circles. Mass protests against racism and aggressive police tactics, though, have shown a spotlight on the immunity defense.
We need legislative change. We need policy change. It's some policies we need to take a look at, qualified immunity.
So what exactly is it? Qualified immunity was created by the Supreme Court half a century ago to protect police from frivolous lawsuits. Supporters say the doctrine is essential to allow officers to make quick decisions in dangerous situations. Critics argue it allows cops to kill or injure others with impunity.
In the Democrat bill, they talked about needing to reduce immunity to go after bad cops, but that would result in police pulling back. So that is one thing that is a non-starter.
So what is that? It's called qualified immunity. Yes. Is that a red line for the president?
That's a non-starter in the Democrat legislation. Yes.
A Reuters analysis of hundreds of federal court cases about the use of excessive force reveals wide disparities in how qualified immunity plays out across the country. If Kali had lived in California instead of Texas, for example, things might have turned out differently. Take Benny Herrera. The father of four was killed in a suburb of Los Angeles in 2011. Like Kali, he had no gun on him when police approached him. Like Kali, he was ordered to take his hands out of his pockets. And like Kali, he was shot when he complied. Herrera died in the hospital. His family fared better than Kali in the excessive force lawsuit they filed. The courts denied the cops' request for qualified immunity. The case was allowed to proceed, and the family eventually secured a $1.4 million settlement. The regional disparities aren't confined to these two cases either. Reuters analyzed over 400 cases at the district court level, where lawsuits are actually filed and heard in Kali's and Herrera's respective states. It found that officers in Texas are almost twice as likely to be granted immunity than in California. Experts say the disparities are due to differing, quote, judicial philosophies. Judges in some regions put more emphasis on police authority, others on individuals' civil rights. The Reuters findings add weight to the arguments for reform.
It made no sense to me. I feel betrayed. I feel abandoned, man. And it hurt. I just feel abandoned.
A broad coalition of politicians, lawyers, scholars, and civil rights groups are clamoring for the Supreme Court to end or rein in qualified immunity. As practiced, critics say, it too often denies justice to victims of police brutality.
Reuters' Jonah Green. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has warned Greece not to test its country's patience, adding to tensions between the NATO allies over energy exploration in the eastern Mediterranean. His comments come as France, Italy, Greece, and Cyprus hold military exercises in the eastern Mediterranean. Erdogan's tough words on Wednesday came despite mediation efforts by Germany's foreign minister a day earlier. Belarusian police have detained more than 50 protesters throughout the country after days of comparative restraint towards mass anti-government rallies. The arrests come as NATO leaders plan to include Belarus in their talks in Germany Wednesday. Protests broke out after the official results of the August 9th presidential election were announced, giving President Alexander Lukashenko his sixth consecutive term in office. Observers say moves by Lukashenko to buy some time likely will see him holding on to power for now, although he almost certainly will face more challenges amid a worsening economy and simmering public anger. Police in Thailand arrested two pro-democracy student protest leaders for taking part in rallies and are charging them with sedition, expanding a crackdown on demonstrators as pressure builds against the government. Those arrested are members of the Free Youth Movement, a core part of a growing pro-democracy coalition, which is demanding that new elections be called, the Constitution be amended, and an end to government harassment of critics. Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha issued a stern warning to protesters, saying they were creating deeper divisions in the country that could cause the collapse of the nation. Fearing their work may violate a national security law recently imposed by Beijing, some Hong Kong artists are turning to self-censorship, while others are moving their creations abroad or are planning to leave the city themselves. Reuters' Libby Hogan reports.
The Hong Kong artist who goes under the pen name Arto has a history of tackling sensitive subjects. His drawings have explored topics censored across the border in mainland China, including the 1989 crackdown on protesters in Tiananmen Square. Today, he dabs with a brush and bleeds the pen strokes of a new illustration, a guillotine ready to slice through a canvas marked freedom of speech. Fearing their creations may violate a new national security law imposed by Beijing, some Hong Kong artists say they're turning to self-censorship.
I'm pretty pessimistic on the creative front. A lot of art usually challenges the traditional ways or criticizes social values. What if artists accidentally cross that red line and the space keeps getting smaller?
The law, acted in June, punishes subversion, secession, terrorism, or collusion with foreign forces with up to life in prison. Critics say it effectively crushes wide-ranging freedoms. While the city government said in a statement to Reuters that the new law upholds the principles of respecting and protecting human rights. Nearly 2,000 Hong Kong and international artists and cultural workers said in a statement the security law created a climate of fear and self-censorship. Some who spoke to Reuters say they are moving their creations overseas or plan to move abroad themselves. Arto's cartoon column was recently axed from the Ming Pao newspaper. The paper said it wasn't because of the new law, but because they were revamping.
During this period of doom and gloom, it's hard not to think it's related to the national security law. Ending my series, I'm definitely not in a good mood. This is the scary thing about the national security law. It's white terror.
Hong Kong's government has ambitions for the city to rival Paris or New York in the art scene. In its statement, the government also said that, quote, art practitioners need not worry as long as they do not contravene the offences as defined under the law, and that, quote, the legitimate rights of Hong Kong citizens to exercise their freedom of speech, such as making general remarks, criticising government policies or officials, should not be compromised. Nevertheless, since the law, pro-democracy protest art has been taken down. A protest anthem has been banned in schools, and pro-democracy books have been taken off library shelves. Despite anxiety over the law, Arto remains defiant.
You have to decide what your values are. You can possibly fear being arrested at any time, or regret that you've not done enough to make an impact on society.
For now, Arto says he will persist and continue to make his political art.
That was Reuters reporter Libby Hogan. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for joining us. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You could do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and good night.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On August 26th, Americans celebrate the 100th anniversary of passage into law of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, which states that the right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. On that day, 26 million American women gained the right to help decide how their country is to function in the future. The women's suffrage movement was officially launched during the first Women's Rights Convention in 1848. Over the following 70 years, suffragists, both women and men, tried every way possible to legalize women's right to vote. They launched a drive to pass a constitutional amendment guaranteeing women the right to vote, a long and tedious process. In the meantime, some women tried to vote illegally and filed lawsuits when their attempts were rejected, hoping the judges would side with them. When that failed, they worked on the state level, where they were much more successful. By the time the 19th Amendment became the law of the land, over half of all states, most of them in the West, had already granted voting rights to women. After making its slow way through the Congress, in June 1919, the 19th Amendment finally received the votes necessary to be sent to the states for ratification by the required 3/4 of the then 48 states. Tennessee became the last state needed to ratify the 19th Amendment on August 18, 1920. In a famous speech from 1873, one of the main leaders of the women's suffrage movement, Susan B. Anthony, looked to the opening words of the U.S. Constitution as a justification for the enfranchisement of women. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. It was we, the people, not we, the white male citizens, nor yet we, the male citizens, but we, the whole people, who formed this union, she said. And we formed it not to give the blessings of liberty, but to secure them, not to the half of ourselves and the half of our posterity, but to the whole people, women as well as men.
That was an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.